This is Jerry Wilmot bringing you London Column. London Column, which brings you items especially chosen for your interest and entertainment in the worldwide service of the BBC. In this edition of London Column, we bring you the voice of Fiorella LaGuardia from Copenhagen, Denmark. We give you a first-hand account of conditions in the Ruhr. You hear the voice of Pandit Nehru from Delhi, India. We bring you an anniversary story of the liberation of Singapore. We take you to Tangmere for news of the world air speed record. British scientist Professor A.M. Lowe discusses a possible journey to the moon. Finally, Stephen Grenfell, our man on the spot, visits London's Underground Railway system. Peace Conference paradoxically considers the many unsettled leftover problems of the war, the members of the Food and Agriculture Organization, meeting in Denmark's capital, figure out what is perhaps the most urgent problem of all, tomorrow's food supplies for the world. In striking contrast to the measured tones of food experts, UNRWA's chief, ex-Mayor LaGuardia, electrifies his audience with his dynamic outbursts.
We do not want to stabilize fluctuations. We want to eliminate fluctuations. Otherwise, you're playing right with the stock exchange. Now, I'm going to be very frank. There's no use trying to gloss over this. There's no use trying to paint it and say we're not going to disturb existing trade practices. There's no use saying we're not going to interfere with free exchange and free sales. If you do what is needed, you will interfere and you'll put every gambling grain exchange out of business in Chicago, in Winnipeg, in Liverpool, or wherever they exist.
That was Fiorella LaGuardia at the FAO conference in Copenhagen. For the past 12 months, Ruth Winston of the Friends Ambulance Unit has been working in a town in the Ruhr which was typical of many others. With 13,000 people living in wooden barracks and 7,000 people in old air raid shelters, she and her fellow welfare workers toiled through the winter in a desperate attempt to improve conditions of incredible squalor.
One day, I called on a mother living with her family of four in a cell almost bare except for two double-decker beds and a table. Each had only one thin blanket, so the children shared beds that they might share blankets. The scant wardrobe of the family was slung on a string across the cell. The mother had no shoes and was crippled with rheumatism. The future held nothing for her that makes life worth living, except hope and a recognition of a poetic justice in life.
That was Ruth Winston on conditions in the Ruhr. The recently formed Interim Government of India is the precursor of a larger scheme which it is hoped will give shape to the constitution of a free and independent India. Listen now to the voice of Pandit Nehru, Vice President of the new national government in office at Delhi.
We shall take full part in international conferences as a free nation with our own policy and not merely as a satellite of another nation. We hope to develop close and direct contact with other nations and to cooperate with them in the furtherance of world peace and freedom.
From Delhi to Singapore. We recall the liberation of Singapore by Allied troops just over a year ago with the story of Elizabeth Choi, one of the thousands of Chinese who lived there during the Japanese occupation.
My husband had been in the hands of Japanese Gestapo for more than 2 years, and I did not know if he was alive or dead. And when I heard the British had come, I spent the whole day going from one Japanese authority to the other with my father, trying to find out about him. At last, I went to the civilian internment camp, and two Englishmen went personally with me to the jail. They went inside to see the Japanese commander while I waited outside. But the commander said he would not release my husband without pass or authority from the British military. And I thought the Japanese Gestapo had killed him and were hiding the fact. But then the two men persuaded the commander to let my husband appear at a window, and my husband said, "Hello." Then I knew he was still alive.
That was Elizabeth Choi of Singapore Island. Weeks ago, preparations were completed at the specially constructed airfield at Tangmere in the south of England for an attempt on the world's airspeed record. A few days ago, under unfavorable conditions after many fruitless postponements, the previous record, also held by Britain, was broken by 10 miles an hour. Here is Group Captain Donaldson of the RAF, who flew one of the Gloucester Meteor planes.
It's interesting and gratifying to note that two runs recorded were over 1,000 kilometers an hour. That is 623 miles an hour. And this is the first time that anybody has exceeded the 1,000 kilometers an hour in level recorded flight. On the runs yesterday, the meteor was quite pleasant to handle, except for the shaking due to compressibility.
From present world airspeed records to dreams of future conquests, a model of an atom-powered spaceship capable of traveling to and from the moon will soon be on view in London. Professor A.M. Lowe, well-known British scientist, discusses the chances of success of a life-size spaceship of similar design.
The real difficulty, of course, with all space travel is fuel. It would need about 5,000 tons of present-day fuel to get a 20-ton rocket into space. And if you wanted to come back again, and I imagine you would, the weight of your ship to go to the moon and back would be about 40,000 tons, and it might cost as much as £20 million. But now the possibility of atomic energy has altered all that, and I think it very likely that within the next century, there really will be a man in the moon. Long before that time, perhaps in 10 or 20 years, we shall probably send space vessels to the moon, which will signal back news of their arrival. And well before that, perhaps during the next few years, we shall have miniature space rockets, which give us meteorological news and ought to make our weather forecasting very much better. Not that that ought to be difficult. But this journey to the moon really will be exciting and interesting. In the first place, when you begin to get outside the Earth's gravity, the passengers would float about inside. But all these little troubles have been worked out in detail by technical men all over the world. And by giving the ship a twist, like a bullet passing through a rifle, the ship will, as it were, carry its own gravity with it. As soon as it gets outside the Earth's atmosphere, it will suffer both the icy cold of space and the burning heat of the sun. But that's not a serious trouble. Nor are the meteorites which might bump into you on the way. In fact, I think that particular risk is far less than crossing the road at Piccadilly Circus.
From contemplation of journeys through interstellar space to an account of a more mundane form of travel, here is Stephen Grenville, London Column's man on the spot, with an up-to-the-minute story of how London's underground railway system works.
Hello, London Column. This is Stephen Grenfell, your man on the spot, calling you this week from the underground railway station, Oxford Circus. Well, only the other day, ex-mayor LaGuardia of New York, now head of UNRWA, traveled on our underground system, and he gave it his considered opinion that it was one of the finest in the world. And, well, London Column, starting off our tour this morning of London's underground system, we arrive at Oxford Circus just outside the overseas service, the BBC, and having our wits about us, catch hold of, as usual, the first top man who is a station master. Your name, sir?
Brooker.
What's your first name?
Frank Brooker.
I better call you Frank.
That's right, I'll do.
Now, Frank, what's your job consist of here, station master of Oxford Circus?
Well, I'm in charge of all the staff, all the trains running through, escalators, lifts, and everything and everybody on the station.
How many staff you got here?
45.
Break them up. What are they, ticket collectors and so on?
Ticket collectors, porters, machine men, booking clerks, and so on.
How many shifts do you run a day? Is you run a very late night service?
We run... But the day is spread up to three shifts.
Yeah.
Three shifts
what
of 8 hours.
Get cracking in the morning?
We start at 5:30 in the morning.
Ouch.
And we...
I said, ouch, 5:30. It's
yes.
The middle of the night.
Oh, well, it's morning to us.
And when do you finish?
We finish at 1 o'clock at night.
Well, then, Colum, in spite of the fact that Mr. LaGuardia publicised the London Tube and underground system, they still run a public relations office, believe it or not. And representative here this morning, Mr. Talbot, looking rather worried, tell us what his job is. It's all yours.
Well, I'm in the press section of the public relations office, and it's part of my job to see that the public is well informed about everything concerning the underground railways, or rather, I should say, London Transport, because it runs more than the underground railways. It also runs all the buses, trams, trolley buses, and coaches in London.
What are the sort of things that are laid down in your department? Have you a system whereby you're never allowed to publish news of suicides, or do you tell the public about...
No, we tell the public everything.
Now, London Column, the next member of the London Passenger Transport Board staff on the witness stand, Mr. Day, who is the district superintendent of this part of line. What's your job, Mr. Day?
Well, my job is to see that the line is running properly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in charge of all operations.
It doesn't
matter just to what degree the line is at fault.
How do you control all these trains running up and down in different directions round about the underground sewers of London? By electricity?
They are, of course, controlled by electricity throughout.
How do you guard against the failure of a man having heart failure or something like that at the signal box?
That's guarded against by what we term the dead man's handle. As soon as a man is taken unwell, the pressure is released on the handle. The result of that is to apply the brakes and remove the current from the motors.
Well, London Column, we didn't have to look very far this morning to pick out of the crowd a satisfied customer. Chap in blue suit, stripes, red tie, brown coat, brown hat. Your name, sir?
My name is Jack Manhangett.
And how do you account, Jack, for the fact that you're a satisfied customer on the Underground? How many years have you been travelling on it?
I've been travelling in London for 35 years on the Underground.
From where to where? I mean, where's your regular run?
All over London.
And where's your regular run at the moment?
On all the stations. Mm-hmm. I go from all stations.
You know all these ticket collectors and people by name, I guess?
I know a great many of them, yes.
And what do you think of the system as a whole? Tell our American listeners something about it.
Well, I think it's very good. I've travelled all over it for 35 years, and I've always got where I wanted to get with expediency and efficiency, I suppose I might say.
Have you ever had any troubles in the rush hours, hanging on the straps or having somebody's elbow pushed in the middle of your back, anything like that?
Oh, well, just a little sometimes, yes. That all comes into it, you know.
Do you think the service is improving? Has improved?
I think it has improved considerably.
What was it like in the days when you first started travelling?
Well, not quite such a rush and not quite such a crush.
As you know, London Column, during the war years, lots of the men went off to fight their battles in different parts of the world, and the women stepped in and became conductresses and clippies and porters all over London, passenger transport board, or portresses. And here's one of them, Mrs. Ferrari. How long have you been in the system, Mrs. Ferrari?
6 years.
What's your actual job?
I'm a female porter.
Does that entail any hard work?
Well, quite a lot of times.
I suppose some of your biggest troubles are women losing children and things like that, or wanting to find a doctor or fainting, I'm sorry.
Yes, we have quite a lot of that. Also their handbags and other accessories by carrying.
What do you do with things like that are picked up?
We take them to the station master, and they'll forward on to lost property, which can be claimed the next following day.
Well, having travelled some 10 or 15 miles around the underground system of London this morning, having met a number of officials, ticket inspectors, district superintendents, publicity men, cleaners, customers, satisfied and otherwise, and not having bought a ticket and having had a season ticket given to us about the next year, this is Stephen Grenfell returning you from the London Underground to the studios of London Column.
Thank you, Stephen Grenfell. And now from London, we send you across the waters of the Atlantic the sound of the bells of one of our oldest churches, the Church of St. Mary the Bow. And to their music, this is your narrator, Jerry Wilmot, closing London Column. This program was written and produced by Peggy Broadhead.